but that somehow we have to take care of people. These ideas converted me into an ardent Roosevelt advocate at that time, and for all three of his re-election campaigns. I was taking freshman German and became a great devotee of Thomas Mann, particularly of his novella Tonio Kreuger. In it, Mann talks about the ambivalence and conflict within Tonio caused by the natural rift between his Prussian father and his warm-blooded, emotional South German mother. The splintering caused by the pulls of these two opposites makes him feel different from others, and he longs to be like everyone else. That may or may not be an accurate reading of this lovely story, but that's how it struck me. I was so carried away and personally involved with the theme that I picked up an English translation and galloped through it, unwilling and unable to struggle with my beginning German. So I was learning, but my work was spotty and disorganized. I had come to college unprepared, lacking the kind of self-discipline needed to read with concentration and the skills necessary to assemble research, give it thought, and write an essay. A history paper I had been assigned to write by an unsympathetic and tough professor, Lucy Textor, is a case in point. I wrote my parents about our conflict. "Am still disagreeing violently with my history teacher. Right now, perhaps my ideas are too general, but I think hers are too specific, i.e., she has taught history 10 years too long. We have a long topic to write just now on anything we wish to. I chose the position of women in the Middle Ages, tracing the similar customs by races from the Saxons in Germany to England, and bringing out the differences in Italy, France, Germany, and England. As they had just begun to obtain rights, it seemed interesting to me to do this for this period, and perhaps again at later periods when we study them. I realize what a tremendous job this is, but she wanted me to take one woman and do her. If I took one woman, she would have to be famous, therefore she would be an exception, which is not what I am after. I am going to try my topic, despite what she said. Even if it doesn't make a good one, I will get what I want out of it. All of this will probably result in a bad mark because we dislike each other. I do my history my own way and enjoy it." The innocence and arrogance of youth are evident here, as well as a budding interest in the position of women. The hated Miss Textor and I came to grief over the ill-prepared paper. She suspected, I suppose, what was really the case, which was that I had done only a half-baked job, and said, "So, Miss Meyer, read us your paper." When I finished reading it, she said, "That's a good introduction. Then what?" Well, it was the end of what I had done. She gave me a D, which resulted in my being put on probation, an embarrassing failure that I resented even while I recognized it as at least partly deserved. Instead of being outraged at me, my mother was outraged at the college. She wrote from Miami Beach that she had raised an awful row with McCracken, then president of Vassar, because they sent me notice you were on History Pro. Dr. McCracken assured me this mark would not stand against you, and you may be sure it won't. In the meantime, please work as never before, and don't say a word about my fusillade against this female. I sent my letter to Dean Thompson. I am furious that they dared send me a report of your being on History Pro, and shall shatter the quiet of Vassar if they don't change things PDQ. I was embarrassed, though somewhat relieved, when I got her letter, but mostly I was worried that her scathing tirades to the dean and the president would create pressure on me to follow up with the goods and write a first-rate paper. In the end, I worked off the probation and passed the course. Midway through my freshman year, I began to feel better about my schoolwork and also to feel that college was growing more interesting and alive. But I had some difficulty with the fact that my mother, it seemed, could outdo my every achievement. Throughout my years of college, it always turned out that she had read all the books assigned to me, read them, assimilated them, critiqued them, dismissed them, even committed them to memory. In a letter to my father in the spring of my freshman year, I wrote that I was reading Tolstoy on the function of art, and found that he agrees with Mother in most of his ideas. How odd that I should have put it this way and not the other way around. What assuaged my spirits was that by this time Connie and I had become seriously interested in politics. We were opposed to a bill in the New York State Senate providing that every member of state-supported institutions, meaning colleges too, because they were tax-exempt, swear allegiance to the Constitution. Hearst was a big proponent of this measure and was backed by the American Legion. I wrote my father, "I hear, Dad, that you disagree with me on this subject. This is not a bit of college communism, however. I think it is absurd. You can't brush out communism by refusing to recognize it." I was appointed treasurer of the college political club and was about to refuse, fearing it was the road to becoming president of the Oshkosh Women's Club. But then, as I wrote my parents, "On the other hand, my friends are good-looking, amusing, and nice, and I thought it would be amusing to see something of the girls that think of nothing but P.P., present problems, and how to convert America to communism. Most of them are madly radical, but some are extremely intelligent about it. My little conservative voice will scarcely be heard above the uproar, but it will be fun baiting the bears." That summer, I was planning to visit my Madeira friend Jean Rawlings in San Francisco. I still have her letter of invitation, telling me about the wonderful things we would do, trips to the mountains with boys who were friends of hers, a rodeo, all enticing. However, my dream of going was suddenly blighted one night when my parents reminded me that there was a serious polio epidemic out west and insisted that I could not go. I remember weeping and telling them that the idea of another summer alone at Mount Kisco was almost unendurable. My parents came up with a solution, a job on one of the chain of suburban Westchester newspapers owned by Noel Macy, later bought by Gannett, and I eagerly grabbed at the idea and went to work on the Mount Vernon Argus. Each day I commuted in a Chevrolet convertible, my first car. It was a non-paying job, but I enjoyed it and enjoyed my associates. I did the menial tasks of telephoning and taking messages, and even wrote a few elementary stories or announcements, including one on women doctors, which was printed with my byline, and which I sent off to my father, who wrote back in an encouraging way, "I think it is very well written. It looks quite professional, in fact, to me." I liked the job because it kept me busy, gave me some time away from the farm, and also gave me a structured life and an idea of what working was like. I was startled to find that the Newspaper Guild had formally protested my working at the Argus for nothing, though individual guild members were personally conciliatory. I had a message from the union head saying, "I wish to explain that we feel no animosity towards you. Those who know you appreciate your efforts to succeed in the field you have chosen. Our action is, and will continue to be, a protest against any publisher who hires an employee without paying him. We hope that you can see our point." At the same time, I had a message from a friend of my mother's saying that she had heard about the guild's teapot furor over you. It was all that damned little communist Dottie Loeb, president and agitator-in-chief, who was at the bottom of it, though some women from Pelham, space riders, had whined a little. The guild seeks to make mountains of any molehill they can find. It was my introduction to union politics. My father and I were growing closer during my college years, while my mother and I were growing apart. He was so shy and inarticulate in expressing emotion that I was always surprised to find him making the attempt. In the fall of 1935, when I was leaving for my second year at Vassar, he wrote me, "I hate to think that soon you'll be off to college and I to Washington, and then only to meet at holidays for another year." And again, when I went to Europe the following summer, he wrote me that he was leaving for the lonely farm, with Kate no longer there to cheer me up. My father and later Phil Graham were among the very few people who ever called me Kate. I was 18 that second year of college. The conflict that had begun the year before between the social life and the intellectual and political life continued to grow. Coming out parties were very much in vogue, the accepted thing in Washington, and a few people still spent the whole year going to parties in different cities where they had family or ties. My own debut is limited to a tea dance at Thanksgiving and a dance on December 26th, done quite splendidly, with the house decorated in a Greek theme and my dress Greek in effect, and gold, not the traditional white. I had learned enough to help with the invitation list and arrangements. My mother had suggested asking young Joseph Alsop, the brilliant young reporter for the Herald Tribune, whom she had recently met. When we were seating the dinner, I put him next to me, intrigued by her description. She had omitted one salient fact, however. Joe, who was fairly short, then weighed about 250 pounds. In addition, he was extremely sophisticated. I was appalled by his appearance and unable to cope with his mature mind and presence, though I got through dinner as best I could. Later, we became lifelong devoted friends, but this was an odd and inauspicious beginning. Accentuating my ambivalence about the two worlds in which I felt myself to be moving, on the day after my big party, Connie and I left by train for Columbus, Ohio, to attend the meeting that established the American Student Union. We had been asked to cover it for the Vassar Miscellany News, on which we both now worked. The union was a combination of communist and socialist student groups, the liberals and the radicals willing to get along with each other and to combine with unaffiliated students for anti-fascist purposes. It was a kind of mirror image of what was happening in the older political world, where the same groups had formed the Popular Front to try to fight the rise of Hitler. We found friends from Dartmouth of more or less similar views and had a good time with Bud Schulberg, later author and movie producer, Eddie Ryan, later on The Post, and Bill Leonard, later head of news for CBS. After going out together for a drink one evening, we returned to the meeting to find that I, who had come as an observer and a reporter, had been put on the National Executive Committee. This was part of a transparent ploy of the left-wing factions to be sure they had enough visible, unattached liberals to be convincing. My first instinct was to remove my name quickly, but a second, which I followed, was to go along with the idea. I was entirely realistic about the reasons for my selection and knew that I was being used. At the same time, I found that this was an interesting and unfamiliar scene and thought I'd take a look and learn what it was all about. When I told my father about being on the committee, he wrote me at length, arguing against journalists joining organizations and suggesting that the fewer labels you wear, the better. In responding to his counsel, I quietly but firmly told him I appreciated the thought he had obviously given to all sides of the question and agreed with most of his points, particularly that there are certain dangers inherent in so-called mass thinking. I also agreed that labels were undesirable, but I explained that it would be difficult for all concerned if I were to resign at that time. My father wrote back at once, thanking me for my letter, and concluding with what is one of the simplest and best precepts for parents to live by that I have ever read. It meant a lot to me then, as it does even today. What parents may sometimes do in a helpful way is to point out certain principles of action. I do not think I would be helpful in advising you too strongly. I do not even feel the need of doing that because I have so much confidence in your having really good judgment. I believe that what I can do for you once in a while is to point out certain principles that have developed in my mind as sound and practical, leaving it for you yourself to apply them if your own mind grasps and approves the principles. This issue, which might have become a separating bone of contention between us, is a good example of how my relationship with my father worked, and the caring and concern that were evident on both our parts. He was probably gently trying to persuade me not to join a group that included communists, but he didn't persist. My mother, on the other hand, did take stands, and indeed political jobs. In the spring of 1936, she was running Alf Landon's radio campaign, although Dad had apparently tried to talk her out of it. As usual, she sprang into action with total enthusiasm. She wrote me that spring with her characteristic excitement about her current project. "Landon is a home run, much more important than the writer chaps have pictured him. I have to do a job." Later, still besotted with her own contribution to his image, she wrote, "I am doing a red-hot talk on Landon the Man on a national hookup. Such fun! Landon's acceptance speech was good, but I can always put him over better than he can because he hasn't the habit of putting himself into speeches. I can't help wondering sometimes what he thinks of himself when I get through with him." She had blinders on to such an extent that when election eve came around, she was still thinking Landon might defeat FDR. At about the same time that she was becoming deeply involved with the Republican campaign, She spoke at a town hall program, a very prominent radio discussion group, with Mrs. Roosevelt presiding. As always, she wrote me in advance to make sure I would tune in, and added as an incentive that she would defend your students' union and jibe at teacher and pupil oaths. I was pleased that she might mention the ASU in her speech, but not a little worried about what she might go on to say. In fact, she got in a row about the New Deal with Mrs. Roosevelt. Her next letter to me expressed hurt feelings at my silence. "I judge from your silence that you did not care for my speech very much. But as far as the world is concerned, I am a hero. Before I left the hall, I began getting telegrams, and when we got back to the hotel, there were numerous long-distance telephone calls, one from Biss, very enthusiastic. The fan mail is coming in hot and heavy, and all of it approving and even enthusiastic. The animosity which the letters breathe for the Roosevelts is unbelievable. I enclose a typical one for your amusement." This was yet another of my one-way conversations with my mother that consisted entirely of her telling me of the overwhelming reception of her latest speeches, mass ovations, and demands for thousands of copies. This kind of self-delusion and overwhelming need for adulation made any exchange with her increasingly difficult for me, and I think for all of us. In the spring of 1936, I got involved in organizing a nationwide peace strike. As if on cue, something else happened that underlined the schisms in my thinking. Connie and I were invited by the seniors at Vassar to be among the few girls picked for the Daisy Chain, allegedly for pulchritude and other sterling qualities, but in reality because they liked you. We were somewhat embarrassed, since the Daisy Chain was an old-fashioned ritual, but secretly we were pleased and soothed our self-conscious selves by composing a poem of acceptance that was titled "To the Upper Class from Two in Chains." Only the second verse of this epic survives and reads, "We thank the class of 36. They've put us in a pretty fix. Between class struggles we must choose the proletariat or use. But we'll not be the CP's bane. We'll organize the Daisy Chain." My mother, on receiving a copy of this poem, responded enthusiastically about the verse, not the tapping, and philosophized, "In this democratic country, nothing makes so much impression as being elected to something. Popularity counts, alas, for a darn sight more than merit. Look at Franklin," meaning, of course, FDR. "The best we can hope is that popularity without merit eventually becomes cloying." Connie and I had discussed making a trip to the Soviet Union that summer following our sophomore year, the summer of 1936. Although my mother's first reaction had been positive, my father vetoed the idea with vehemence. I pleaded for Russia, arguing politely that we could book an exciting and cheap tour conducted by Intourist, which I called the reliable and official Russian travel bureau. I added fuel to my argument, I thought, by saying that we would shorten our planned stay in the Soviet Union to 2 weeks. We would go in the early part of the summer, when Connie's family would still be in Western Europe, and therefore close enough to help us if there were a problem, and I would be back to spend September on the post with my father. Dad did not agree with my logic. He telegraphed his okay to Western Europe only, and followed up with a letter explaining his reasons. "These are very troublous times, more so than I can expect you to realize. You know, I am sure, that I do not say no to you lightly. You are one kid that is generally so reasonable in everything that I am anxious always to say yes to you. I can't see you going so far to the eastern part of Europe, under present conditions, unless I was free to devote myself solely to the job of getting you out in case of trouble. I am not in that position now. Much love. Maybe you and I will go there together some day." When Connie and I left for Europe at the end of June, we made quite a traveling troupe, given Connie's parents, her four sisters, and a nurse or maid. Her father was constantly calling to the French porters, "Neuf personnes et 29 pièces de bagage," 9 people and 29 pieces of luggage. We went first to London, and although I recognized the seriousness of the political situation, I found it quite a gay place, with everyone excited about the King's garden parties. In Paris, Léon Blum, the socialist, was the head of a popular front government, and politics made themselves felt everywhere, exacerbated for us, no doubt, by our having arrived in the city on the day before Bastille Day. In addition to the usual military parade, there was a popular front demonstration which gave me the most impressive feeling of communal strength I had ever had. There were two separate marching lines that eventually met and came together, singing, into the Place de la Bastille. The spirit with which the crowds poured in, about 750,000 strong, made it easy to visualize previous scenes at the same location. Connie and I joined the march, attaching ourselves to the boulanger, a group of bakers, and walking with them for a couple of hours. As if to make an even greater point of our being pulled in opposite directions at once, we broke off from the popular front parade to have lunch with my Aunt Elise, who had left San Francisco after her husband died and taken up residence in a beautifully decorated house in Paris, where she became a successful and prominent social figure. After some time, Elise married the Brazilian ambassador to France, Luis de Souza Dantas, who by length of service had become dean of the diplomatic corps, a position of some eminence. Our morning's march was in marked contrast to Elise's usual activities, and it amused her greatly that Connie and I had joined her lunch straight from the parade. She kept telling us throughout the meal to tell Princess So-and-so and Sir So-and-so what you did this morning. So we led a highly varied life on our trip. In Paris, I took Connie to have dinner with Brancusi one night. I was so eager to see him that I rang the bell madly and burst into the studio when the door opened, only to be confronted by a strange face. Full of the exuberance of youth, I exclaimed, "My goodness, where's Brancusi, and who are you?" He turned out to be Pierre Matisse, Henri's son, and he stayed to dinner. The four of us ate in Brancusi's totally white studio, sitting on blocks of marble around another huge chunk of marble, which served as the table. When it was time to eat, Brancusi produced large sheets of a kind of shiny white paper and put them around like placemats. My memory is that everything we ate was white, too, although I'm sure that wasn't the case. We returned to England for a student meeting at Oxford and lunch with Harold Lasky, and then were off to Salzburg, where Mother had treated us to the Hotel Bristol and tickets to the music festival there. Because I had heeded my father's instructions to stay well on the western side of Europe, Connie and I now parted company as she headed for the Soviet Union. But though I was sad to see her leave without me for the great adventure, I don't remember any feeling of resentment at having been forbidden to go with her. I had accepted my father's verdict. Chapter 5. On a train trip to Mount Kisco with my father later that summer, I broached the idea of my studying at the London School of Economics, as my brother Bill had, the following year. It was met with an immediate no. He believed that Bill had been too young intellectually, too immature, to put European social problems in context, and he thought I was too. But he said that he understood why I wanted to leave Vassar, and that it was all right with him if I went anywhere else in this country. I was so taken aback that I could hardly think of an alternative to London. But I thought I had to respond instantly, rather than do the natural thing, which was to think it over. So I made an instantaneous decision. I hit on the University of Chicago, not out of a sudden impulse toward serious study, but simply because there flashed into my mind a picture I had seen while flipping through the pages of Red Book magazine of Robert Maynard Hutchins, the university's young, handsome, dynamic president. The cut lines under his picture said that he was revolutionizing the learning process and shaking things up with new and interesting ideas about college education, and that the university was in an intellectual ferment, or something of the sort. I hadn't focused on it as I flipped the page, but now I added things up quickly. It was in the Midwest, I had never lived off the eastern seaboard, it was coeducational, and it was in a city. "Okay," I said, "I'll go to Chicago." And in fact, with no more thought than that, off I went, arriving in Chicago less than a month after our conversation on the train. I hadn't foreseen the magnitude of the decision I'd made, and didn't realize what I was in for until I was already in the thick of it. My father had come with me to Chicago to enter me in the university and find me a place to live, but once he left, I was completely on my own in a strange environment and a sea of thousands of students, with only one or two casual acquaintances. Maybe it was lucky that I hadn't had the time or the sense to envision being so alone. I might well have pulled back. Probably I reassured myself with the thought that I was planning to stay only 1 year and could always return to Vassar. Indeed, I kept that safety net by telling the college I would be back. But little by little, life sorted itself out, and the university was good for me. Eventually, I found my way, growing to love the place and staying on to graduate. I lived on the edge of the campus, at International House, which was filled with foreign students, graduate students, and some transfer students like me. We all ate in the cafeteria, sitting at round tables that afforded opportunities for making friends and acquaintances of every kind. Before too long, I met and became roommates with Taylo Hannaford, a like-minded girl from Winnetka who had transferred from Sarah Lawrence, and gradually we assembled a nucleus of friends. We both were entranced with a graduate student, Sydney Hyman, who was much around the house. Early on, Sydney and I fell into conversation about our shared enthusiasm for Thomas Mann, and we talked for hours, cementing a friendship that moved with me through the years. Fun, for our group, was talk, exchange of ideas, laughter, close harmony singing, and hours at the college beer parlor, Hanley's, which had a long bar, in front of which was a row of small square tables with red and white checked tablecloths, where you could sit with your friends and nurse a beer or two all night. After a few months, I was approached by members of two different clubs, Mortarboard and Quadrangle, similar to sororities, suggesting that I join. I went to a meeting of one where lots of young women were sitting around, many of them playing bridge. It wasn't the kind of atmosphere I was used to, even at Vassar. Shortly afterwards, a friend of mine who was a member of Mortarboard asked if I was really interested in joining and said that if I was, she would go to bat for me. She was willing to take on a fight about my being Jewish, but not if there was nothing to be served by fighting. Having had no idea that my being considered Jewish was an issue, I was startled and assured her that I wasn't really interested. Later, a friend told me that the Quadrangle had actually disbanded over the question of admitting me to membership. This was one of the very few instances in which anti-Semitism touched me directly in those early years, and I was more surprised than distressed by it. Chicago, then, was a center of intellectual turmoil. The university was a distinctly urban school, with mostly non-affluent students, some excellent faculty, and high intellectual standards. Because Hutchins had become enthralled by the theory that education consisted in reading the great books of the Western world and absorbing their ideas, the academic program was very different from that at most colleges. Hutchins had been influenced by Mortimer Adler, who was the leading exponent of these ideas, and by St. John's College, where they had previously been tried out. Hutchins had also abolished football and other athletics. The whole thing was slightly flaky, but stimulating, a universe of its own, and important for me, a far cry from Vassar. I had decided on American history as my major, so I enrolled in survey courses in economics and in history, and despite some trepidation, the course in the great books taught jointly by Hutchins and Adler. It started with Plato and Aristotle, worked up through St. Thomas Aquinas and other philosophers, and ended with Freud and Marx and Engels. This class, which was supposed to teach you how to read a book, as Adler later titled one of his own books, met once a week for two solid, sometimes torturing hours. About 30 of us sat around an oblong table, and Hutchins or Adler or both would use the Socratic method in discussing what we had read and testing us. For the whole 2 hours, the two men hammered away, bullying us unmercifully. "Well, Miss Meyer, tell us in your own words what Aristotle thinks about this. What do you think about what he says? Do you really think that good behavior follows from good values? What are good habits? What are good values? If that's what you think, what if such and such happened?" The methods they used often taught you most about bullying back, about standing up to Hutchins and Adler, about challenging them and fundamentally pleasing them by doing it with gusto and verve, so that they were amused. If you learned to cope with their methods, you could stay afloat. When I didn't do well, the most awful depression set in, because so much depended on that performance. When I did do well, my elation carried over to everything else I was doing at the university. Despite its intimidations, the course was good for me, and I actually got an A in it at the end of the first year. My father, who strongly believed in Chicago's educational theories, was thrilled at my grade and sent me a check for $100, which I said I would spend on books by Plato and Aristotle to commemorate the event. I suggested he may have overreacted because marks don't mean much out here, and Adler usually deals them out pretty irrationally. Though he teaches logic, he knows better than to base his conduct upon it. For all I knew, I added, the marks may have been the result of the rides home in the car when, as I told you, we got on very well. I was still finding it difficult to learn the right balance between social and academic activities. Mrs. Kellogg Fairbank, a friend of my mother's, who once described herself to me as that person in Chicago who voted for Landon, was my one link, except for Taylor, to the social scene beyond the university. She lived in a large, stylish lakefront apartment and occasionally included me in her lunch or dinner parties and invited me to her weekend house. After these events, I always made what I thought was the polite card gesture, often worrying about whether I was supposed to leave one card or two and whether I had to turn the corner down. Even as a college junior, and while the outside world was changing so dramatically, I was concerned to make sure I was adhering to the proper ways, doing the correct thing, making the appropriate gesture. Through an old beau of my sister Flo's, I met a classicist émigré professor, Giuseppe Antonio Borghese, whose book Goliath I had read and respected. I found him to be a bit of a madman, but very entertaining and very bright. Soon afterwards, I was excited and flattered to be invited to dinner by Borghese. We ate in downtown Chicago, a great treat, since we students lived almost exclusively in South Chicago, the area around the university. On the way back from dinner, he quizzed me about how many of my classmates I thought were still virgins, a question entirely beyond my ability to answer or even guess at. There were other leading questions, followed by an invitation to inspect his apartment. I was still so young and unsuspecting that poor Borghese obviously took my acceptance as an agreement to amorous advances, but being so naive about sexual relations, I was surprised when the distinguished professor made a pass at me. When I resisted, he pursued me, and I found myself racing around his desk, the professor in pursuit. Finally, I insisted on leaving, and he drove me home. Surprisingly, he called and asked me out again. I was in such a panic about offending the great man that I went to the university's infirmary and insisted I had appendicitis. When the doctors assured me I was in fine health, I had to tell the professor I was unable to go out with him. A monstrously difficult thing for me to do, it almost killed me with mortification. My political outlook developed further as a committed liberal, primarily passionately anti-fascist and sympathetic toward the labor movement. Yet, though I was engaging in liberal thinking and activities, I remained basically conservative. I had never encountered real communists until I reached Chicago. The American Student Union there was very different from the one I'd left behind at Vassar, which had been run by girls who were relatively new to politics and whose passions, the political ones at least, weren't all that deep. I was greeted effusively by the Chicago branch of the union, which was mostly composed of communists and socialists of a rather boring mindset. An exception was a young British graduate student, Norman O. Brown, a Commonwealth Fellow, who took me to a few meetings and to dinner. He kept suggesting that I join the young communists, since they and the parent party were the most effective anti-fascist forces in the world. At that time, with the rise of Hitler and Mussolini, and Franco fighting against the forces of Spanish democracy, this argument could be made with some force. The ghastly crimes of Stalin had not yet been revealed, and when the famous trials started, they were, at least initially, viewed ambivalently by even the liberals among us. I remained unpersuaded, and wondered whether Brown might be a communist himself, assigned to convert me. In response to his proselytizing, I eventually wrote him a letter, which I later found in one of my textbooks and probably never sent, in which I said that, although my parents were doing certain things with which I disagreed, I loved them, was grateful for the circumstances into which I was born, appreciated what I had, and had no desire to revolt against any of it. I didn't want to help overthrow a system that I knew I belonged to, although I certainly understood that there were problems that should be addressed. I'm not sure why, when many of my friends had joined the party, I had the resolve to reject it. Perhaps there was a balancing weakness at work, one that had long been a part of me, that inherent desire to conform, to please, to abide by laws, to be a good girl, if you will. Anyway, very luckily for the Washington Post during the McCarthy era, when we were constantly being attacked as Reds by various constituencies, I never had been a member. In the spring of my first year at Chicago, I took a course on labor relations from Paul Douglas, later a United States senator, and grew interested in labor problems. This was a time of broad-scale industrial organization that was being resisted by the steel, coal, and automobile companies in extremely forceful, even violent ways. My sympathies lay with the right to organize, and they haven't changed in that respect, although I have grown to regard some union leadership and tactics with a degree of skepticism. But at this time, the great mass of workers in the industrial area had no way of dealing jointly with employers. I became friends with Ralph Beck, a young man who was stringing for the Chicago Daily News and covering the Chicago steel strike. The Republic Steel Plant in South Chicago, not too far from the university, was being struck, and Ralph called to tell me that there was going to be a confrontation of some sort between the strikers and the company, and invited me to go with him to observe it. I agreed with enthusiasm. The picketers were facing armed Chicago police. I was not in danger, being at some distance, but I was scared. Ralph had left me behind for safety and had gone nearer. The steel workers advanced, and the guards or the police suddenly fired on them, killing seven and wounding others. Pandemonium and fear of arrest spread, even to where I was standing, and we all piled into any available vehicles and fled this horrifying scene. After recovering from this traumatic event, we returned once or twice to the struck plant, and it occurred to us to wonder what was going on inside. Ralph suggested we try to find out. I asked for permission, mentioning the Washington Post as well as the Daily News, and learned a never-to-be-forgotten lesson about the power of a Washington newspaper, even though the Post was a minor one at that time. We were invited in and toured the plant with its officials, somewhat to my embarrassment and surprise, a college junior and her stringer friend. I wrote Casey Jones, explaining and apologizing for using the paper's name to gain entry. He answered that he had gotten a bang out of our experience and thought the picture we'd received of the way a big strike works was equivalent to a year's work in any economics course, and graciously sent a letter of introduction for future use. Many years later, I was to get a more graphic and personal lesson about labor relations. My father and I kept up a constant conversation through the mail in which the Post often figured. Although it was improving editorially and even attracting more ads, Dad was being worn down by the seemingly impossible task of getting it out of the red. Costs were rising. The Herald had the blue-collar readership locked up, in part because of its famous third page, the sex and crime page. The Times was the afternoon version of the Herald. Scripps Howard had a solid, jazzy tabloid niche, newsstands and lunch sales, and the Evening Star seemed to own the market and the town. It was the respectable establishment paper, overflowing with ads. Dad wrote me in the spring of 1938, almost 5 years into the struggle to make the Post succeed, that he had had one of those lucky breaks that sometimes occur. He was offered the Herald Tribune service, which meant columns by Walter Lippmann, Dorothy Thompson, and Mark Sullivan, some desirable comics and Sunday features, daily crossword puzzles and bridge articles, and book reviews, a rich trove which he grabbed. The Star had had the Tribune service, and through a difference of opinion over cost, it landed in our lap. The Post also got some routine coverage from the Herald Tribune's Washington Bureau, which relieved our small national staff. In addition, we got foreign news from their correspondents abroad, which we could not afford at that time. My father wrote, "Yesterday, Mr. Newbold of the Star visited me and told me it was very disturbing to them, and they would like to divide the service with us. But as they did not offer to divide it with us when they had it themselves, I don't know why we should divide it with them when we have it. Do you?" He described a lunch at the French Embassy with Arthur Kroc of the New York Times, Fred Essery of the Baltimore Sun, Felix Morley, then the Post's editorial page editor, Sir Wilmot Lewis of the London Times, and myself from the Wash Post. He added charmingly, "Such things make me feel like a regular newspaper guy. Circulation 108,500 and going up, 110,000 by sooner than you think." Then he added movingly, especially in view of how small the Post was at the time and how difficult the struggle, "P.S. If you don't soon get down here on the Post, there won't be anything left to do but the routine jobs of trying to hold our position. You ought to be in on the job of putting it to the top. It is much better sport fighting to get there than trying to stay there after you have gotten there. When we get there, I will go out looking for some trouble somewhere, and let you, Mother, Casey Jones, and Felix Morley keep the machine running." What did he mean, and what did I think? Looking back, I can only assume that I wanted to be a journalist and that he had a newspaper. I'm sure that he wasn't writing to my sisters or even my brother in this way. I am equally sure that neither one of us saw me as a manager. It interests me how he and I assumed at the time that I would be a journalist. One contribution I did make to the Post was in the all-important area of the comics. I told my father about the comic strip Terry and the Pirates, which was the talk of Chicago and was then relatively new. He found it available and picked it up with great success. I felt pleased to have helped. Right after Roosevelt's overwhelming victory in 1936, someone wrote the Post a letter suggesting welcoming the victorious president back to town. Next day, the paper published a front-page box headed, "Let's give the president a real welcome." The response was remarkable. 200,000 gathered at Union Station at 8 o'clock in the morning to hail the champ, who rewarded Dad with a special wave to his second-floor window on Pennsylvania Avenue. I wrote a rather sour letter to my father about this event, saying that I thought it was corny and trying to have it both ways, and that for me this was one of the Post's lower moments, to which he responded instantly and aggressively. He thought it was a great idea and reported that other papers had participated too. He further defended himself by saying the Associated Press had carried the story and even Time had mentioned it. He added, "I am afraid that your Chicago atmosphere and remoteness prevents your exercising the good, keen journalistic understanding on this matter, which I know you would have been capable of had you been here on the spot." This was as overt a difference as we ever had. Even when he was criticizing my judgment, he was always kind and supportive. It says a lot for my father's equanimity that he was unbothered by this kind of exchange. In fact, he relished differences of opinion and sharp exchanges as signs that people had minds of their own. For example, he had started small trust funds for all of us at birth. He did this because he felt his own father had used money to control his children, and he didn't want to do the same thing. He wanted us to be independent of his will. What I didn't grasp at the time was my father's real bias in my favor, the depth of his caring. My mother's hints that he had a crush on me and the stories she relayed of his hoarding my letters didn't sink in. In retrospect, I can see this intense affection we had for each other and what an enormous influence he had on my life, my plans, and my thinking. I'm not sure why I wasn't aware of it at the time, but it's clear to me now that he believed in me, which became a very powerful emotional asset as I grew older, and gave me a measure of security which I greatly needed. Relations with my mother were different. She was becoming more and more difficult and self-centered. It was hopeless to ask her a personal question or for advice. She had constructed an image of what we were all like and what our lives were like, and she never really looked to see if the reality fit her image. After the 1936 election, Mother returned to Washington a little sadder, not too much so, and a good deal wiser. My father, not really one to say I told you so, did take some consolation from having advised her to stay out of the job she had gotten herself into with Landon. My one meeting with her candidate was a perfect example of the contrast between the two worlds in which I was moving, that of my Republican parents and my more liberal university environment. Just a few weeks after the election, I was taking the overnight train home for the Thanksgiving holiday. Sidney Hyman and some other friends came down to the station to see me off, and as a goodbye bouquet, presented me with a real hammer and sickle tied up with a red bow. There was nothing to do with this awkward joke but take it with me. I arrived home next morning still carrying the unwieldy implements, and walked into the Washington house, where the door was opened by the butler, and I found my parents in the library conferring with the defeated candidate, Alf Landon himself. I hastily disposed of the hammer and sickle before joining them. It was during the 1930s that my mother started seriously on her career of speechmaking on a variety of issues, particularly welfare and education. Her letters to me were fuller than ever of accounts of speeches, of audience sizes, and of the enthusiastic reaction she always received, and the many demands for copies. She had enormous and wide-ranging intellectual interests and wrote on many subjects. In fact, at this point, her life centered on her writing. For a couple of years, she often went alone to the cabin, as we called the lovely smallish modern house my parents had built, overlooking the Potomac River in Virginia, about half an hour from town, to work on her book on Tolstoy, Dostoevsky, and Mann. It was during this time that she began another of her passionate friendships with men, one that consumed her and threatened her equanimity, even as it sustained and enriched her. This one was with Thomas Mann, and even before she met the man himself, she had fallen for him through his writings. Having earlier discovered his novels for myself, I had become an enthusiast, but my mother went further. In April of 1937, she finally saw Mann in person when she went to New York to hear him lecture on Wagner at the New School and was completely bowled over by the experience, calling him an absorbing if unrequited passion, admiring him as both a writer and a human being. A second lecture, on Freud, only increased her first impression that here was one of the few authentically great men of the day. She was delighted to find that such a great soul exists in our poor age, and immediately decided to interview him for the post. She who was cynical about conspicuous members of society, or so she claimed, she who described herself as someone who would rather meet an honest shoemaker than the average artist, was so overcome with emotion when she arrived for the interview, to be held in German, of course, that she scarcely felt equal to the task. When she actually met him, her excitement was unbounded and contagious. In a letter to me, she described the experience in great detail and revealingly. His wife, a brilliant-eyed, charming, rather elderly woman, received me, and my confusion increased when I realized I would have to interview him in front of her. Three men had to be put out before I was admitted, and I could see other people waiting impatiently for me to get out. That isn't exactly conducive to a helpful atmosphere, and together with my attack of hero worship well-nigh made me speechless when the great man came forward to greet me. It took all the training and self-control that I have ever had to proceed, but I had planned an intelligent question which I now heard myself reciting like a schoolgirl. A flash of recognition of my question's validity was visible, and then I could almost see him reach up to a certain definite compartment of his mind where just the right answer was stored. For 15 minutes, he talked like a machine gun in the most fluent, subtle German, with long, perfect sentences and paragraphs just as precise and complicated as his written style. I never once looked up at him, because I had to write like mad to get some of his vocabulary and a few of his ideas. When he had finished, his wife indicated that my time was up. We exchanged a few more remarks, revealing on my part a well-nigh subnormal intelligence, and after a short exchange of courtesies with his wife, I took my broken heart and my wounded vanity into the street. When my mother returned to Washington from the meeting, she was still so uplifted by Mann's words, the power of his personality, and her belief in his importance to liberal thought throughout the world, that she wrote him her version of a fan letter. The next day, exhausted, as she said, by the storm of my emotions, she set to work on the interview, which duly appeared in the Post. This experience with Mann, or more important, the strength of her feelings for him, compelled her to advise me, "Be a newspaper woman, Kay, if only for the excuse it gives you to seek out at once the object of any sudden passion." Mother's physical problems were always dramatized, as were her emotional ones. As her attachment to Mann grew, so too did her emotional instability. The first overt evidence of a serious problem occurred the summer of 1937 at our ranch in Wyoming. My parents had picked me up that summer after I finished my courses in Chicago and took Ruthie and me to the ranch to spend some time there relaxing. It was a traumatic stay. Mother was going through a king-sized change of life, and I suppose depression exacerbated her already highly excitable state. She had started to drink noticeably by then. One day, when we were all out for a ride in the beautiful valley, her horse ran away with her. Ruthie, an excellent rider, far better than I, was nearest to her and took out after her, as did the cowboys. Her horse was caught and somehow stopped, but something had snapped. It was an emotional explosion. She went completely to pieces, fought with my father, and generally retreated from him into her own cabin, where she started to drink seriously. We were all deeply disturbed. My father could do nothing with her, and it fell to me to try to help her, to find out what was the matter and try to calm her down. The day after the runaway horse scare, she climbed up a nearby mountain. I went after her, really worried about what she might do, she was so distraught, and finally caught up with her near the top, where we sat down and talked. Some of the time I talked, while she wept. She had got so fervently involved with Mann and his writing that he seemed bound up in all her thoughts and feelings. When she talked, she concentrated on how wonderful he was, how much he meant to her, how brave and perceptive he was, how she understood him and could help him, what a terrible world it was in which he was an exile from his country and in which even people here in the United States didn't understand or appreciate him. Luckily, I could sympathize, so I was able to discuss, there in the most incredible of settings, his writings and greatness with her, and eventually to calm her down enough to get her off the mountain. But for the rest of our stay on the ranch, she remained more or less secluded, in bed, or drinking but not communicating, especially not with my father. From then on, I increasingly began to act as an adult, to help with Ruthie, still in high school at Madeira, and quite often with my mother. On a personal level, you had to sustain her, and very little came back in exchange. This was especially hard on Ruthie, who, being at home, was required to fit in with whatever mother needed or wanted to do. Without realizing it, mother was using Ruthie for company. I found I actually enjoyed the responsibility and being of help, and during this time my father and I grew even closer. The fact that I shared his interest in journalism and public issues no doubt increased our closeness, but so did my helping with my mother's distress. By the end of my first year at Chicago, I had decided I wouldn't return to Vassar, but would stay on. I had found an intellectually stimulating academic environment, had developed wonderful friendships, had grown up significantly, and enjoyed myself very much indeed. But I went on experiencing the usual angst about who I was and how to survive the great strength and influence of the family. I had occasional romantic flirtations, sometimes on my part, sometimes on a young man's, but rarely both at once. One of these attachments was a strange emotional relationship with a political scientist, Hal Winkler, who was much shorter than I, but very intense and passionate. I was always attracted physically to brilliance, and he was brilliant, or so it seemed to me, but I was still shy and virginal and didn't know how to cope with sexual advances. I apparently went on looking a great deal more directed and together than I felt. One of the most significant things to occur in the fall of my senior year was a visit from my sister Biss, who was then working in California. I was always excited at the prospect of seeing Biss, who had been in Europe, New York, and Hollywood, while I was in Washington, Vassar, and Chicago. Her friends remained glamorous and even famous. In Europe, she had somehow grown friendly with Queen Marie of Romania and her daughter, Princess Iliana. In New York, she had been friendly with and even courted by the playwright Sam Berman, and she saw a good deal of George Gershwin, Oscar Levant, and Harpo Marx, visited the famous Herbert Swope and his wife, and knew Alexander Woolcott, Dorothy Parker, and others of the Algonquin set. She had a serious romance with a movie producer whom she wanted to marry, an idea nixed by my mother, who thought it unsuitable. Mother once told me proudly how she had stopped Biss from going to Hollywood and marrying this young man. She said she went up to our family's New York apartment, where Biss was living, and argued with her for a week. Biss remained adamant until my mother said, "Biss, if you do this, it will kill your father." And that, said my mother with satisfaction, stopped her. The visit Biss and I had in Chicago was extraordinary. We spoke at length about the complexity of being a member of this overwhelming Meyer family, of what it meant positively and negatively, and of what we both wanted to do with our lives. On the train, even as it was pulling out of the station, Biss began a long letter to me, so full of her essence and so full of insight into the family that I've kept it always. She wrote on November 20th, 1937. "I wish I had had time to talk about your own problems, which in the light of my experiences seem very difficult and complicated. One of the hardest problems for all of us is the one which I believe is at the root of Flo's doings, and which I see little or no hope of her even realizing, let alone solving. That is, the difficulty arising from the fact that from earliest childhood we have all, through what is said and what is unsaid in the family circle, had the feeling that we were born to do big things. It was just a question of choosing the line best suited to us, hardly even the line we were best suited to. There was no question but that whatever it was, we had to be best at it. Mother even used to say that, remember? 'I don't care what any of you kids do, even if one of you should want to be an actress, just so you're the hell of a good actress.' We have all felt a compulsion to be terrific, and that is a dangerous thing. It is awfully hard for us really to give our best to something low, small, unimportant. We have lived so long at the top in every respect that it is hard to make ourselves really at home, with roots, at the bottom of the mountain. And that is the only way we will ever grow, if any of us do, to be able to climb under our own power." It took me almost a month to reply, but when I did, it was a summation of what I was thinking about work, the family, the post, and in particular my father. Biss kept my letter and returned it to me decades later. On the subject of Meyerdom, I have plenty to say, even though I don't pretend to understand it completely, either its causes or its effects. It can be compared, obviously enough, with an octopus whose tentacles stretch far and wide, and what is worst of all, deep. In other words, if you try to run from it, you are apt to find it within. More concretely, this is the way it is working itself out for me at this point. To begin somewhere in a circular situation, I think I want to go into the newspaper business. This is because I have certain political views which may or may not change, combined with the fact that I like to write. Putting aside an unanswerable question at this time, my ability to be a good reporter, which is a gift given by God to a very few, I mean good reporter, the fact remains that what I am most interested in doing is labor reporting, possibly working up to political reporting later. As you can see, that is no help to Dad. He wants and needs someone who is willing to go through the whole mill, from reporting to circulation management and problems to editorial writing and eventually to be his assistant. This presents the payoff in problems. One, I detest beyond description advertising and circulation, and that is what a newspaper executive spends most of his time worrying about. Two, there is a question of point of view, which would or might complicate things if I were to work under Dad. And three, I doubt my ability to carry a load like the Washington Post. And four, I know Dad needs a different kind of person, much more of an automaton under him. And five, I damn well think it would be a first-class dog's life. discarding finally for a moment the idea of ever having anything to do with the W Post. There are more theoretical results to be questioned and tested. As I said long ago at the beginning of this letter, Meyer tentacles clutch deep. From Dad's point of view, I think it would mean something. I may be flattering myself, but I think it would mean several things, such as companionship, a living connection with the next generation, and the knowledge that all that he was slaving to build was not going to stop with him. From my point of view, it would be giving up a position that is fair to say thousands would fight for, that is an influential position, in an influential paper, in the capital of the world's most important country. Right now, anyway. Besides that, it would mean losing valuable help, company, and advice, which has already influenced me a great deal and which I respect highly. If I find, for some reason, that I am not fitted to do newspaper work, and this may happen, as among other things I function a little on the slow side, which is not good, I shall get out and consider it no disgrace. I don't think this is part of the success idea, because by fitted, I mean simply a competent, not scintillating, job. Though that is made difficult by our heritage, I should think it could be worked out practically, though I can't tell from my present ivory tower window. And some day I think I shall marry a man. That is because by nature I do not like to live alone. I like to live with somebody, and if you live with someone, it is nice to be married. So maybe I shall devote myself, as Flo always used to prophesy with hoots of mirth, to having 16 small ones and bringing them up to be unsuccessful and rather animal in their desires, with as little as possible of that specialized human quality called the rational. This letter seems to me to summarize who I was and what I was thinking after 4 years of college, better than I can do it nearly 60 years later. I am puzzled that I had such reservations about working for my father, in view of the continuing conversations he and I were having about my education and career in journalism and the progress of the Post. I suppose the answer has to be that I was ambivalent, and maybe so was he, since he and I later both enthusiastically endorsed my husband's going on the Post and my going off to lead the life of wife, mother, and good works. My stay at the University of Chicago, this noble institution, as I referred to it to my parents, ended in early June of 1938. My marks throughout my tenure at Chicago were not as good, or as bad in some cases, as they might have been. I didn't think it mattered, particularly since I felt I had learned a lot during my 2 years there. There seems to have been no discussion about my parents coming to whatever graduation formalities there were. I don't believe I thought of graduation as a momentous event, but the fact that my parents didn't come has been built into a trauma in various accounts, in one of which I am portrayed as weeping. I can't in fact remember why they didn't come, and to tell the truth, I can't remember attending the graduations of my own children. Perhaps I inherited delinquency in this respect, or perhaps the 60s generation turned their backs on this kind of event. We graduated in the beautiful Rockefeller-built chapel, the ceremony presided over by President Hutchins. And then, after partying with my friends, and with my formal education behind me, I left Chicago for Mount Kisco and a fairly uncertain future. Chapter 6. While I was home after graduating, my father suggested that I accompany him to California, land of his youth. I scarcely knew the California branch of my family, but I quickly fell in love with them, and with San Francisco as well, its beauty and its people, the civic feeling, the friendliness, the informality. Very soon I came to think that it would be wonderful to work in such a congenial atmosphere and beautiful environment, so I resolved to try to stay. I told my father that if he would help me find a job there, I would swallow my pride and give up a job I had earlier got for myself in Chicago. There were 4 newspapers in San Francisco at that time. In the morning, the Chronicle was the predominant and most respected voice. The competition was Hearst's Examiner, the best and strongest Hearst paper of a then still vibrant empire. The 2 afternoon papers exemplified typical old-fashioned razzle-dazzle street sales journalism, bursting with huge headlines, late-breaking stories, and much more sex and crime than the morning papers. My father called his friend George Deke Parker of Scripps Howard, and it was on their paper, the San Francisco News, that he found me a 2-month job. Our competitor in the afternoon was another Hearst paper, the Call Bulletin. I am surprised that my father didn't turn to his friends on the Chronicle, the better-known and more traditional paper, but the News turned out to be a great blessing for me, because it was a typically informal, understaffed, rowdy, scrappy, amusing afternoon tabloid, ideal for a beginner breaking in, since it afforded me opportunities I couldn't have had in a more structured, orderly atmosphere. But things didn't start out all that happily. I went to the City Room, knowing no one, and worse, not knowing the elements of the job. I hadn't done much typing, and certainly not much reporting. I didn't know the city or how to get around in it. Everything seemed so suddenly overwhelming. I sat down at my desk and was gripped by fear of failure, lost and defeated before I'd begun. My father had stayed over a few days, and I went to his room one night and in tears told him that I was afraid I'd bitten off more than I could chew, that I felt unable to do the job and would be of little use to the paper, certainly not worth the $21 a week I was being paid, and that I wanted to go home with him. Dad said simply that everyone had to learn, that maybe I should take some more time before deciding to give up the job, and that if I wasn't worth the whole $21 a week now, I'd be worth much more than that later, since I would gradually learn the things I was so discouraged about now. What persuaded me, I'm not sure, but I agreed to stay, knowing I could always give up later. Just one short month after my tearful desire to run away, my new life had become lots of fun. By mid-August, I was beginning to feel that there were more ups than downs. A touch of ambition was taking hold, and I could see further ahead than the next paragraph. I realized that not just the News, but San Francisco itself was a good place for me to be starting work, since no one knew I was connected with newspaper big shots, and if some people did, they didn't care. Most people, in fact, had never heard of the Washington Post, and some, I suspected, hadn't heard of Washington. On the job, I was learning to write or rewrite from phoned-in news. It was still taking me too long to write, but my stories were appearing with fewer alterations by the editors on the Callis City desk. I was also doing elementary jobs, like tracking down people for pictures. I even covered a bartender's union convention. My first serious assignment was cooked up by some editor. The Women's Christian Temperance Union was meeting in town, and he suggested I lure some of the delegates to a bar with the simple proposition that they view the scene of the crimes they were railing against and do a story on the visit. I duly got the deed done and written up. After I had been on the job only a short time, my neighbor in the City Room, Bob Elliott, the News's experienced professional labor reporter, leaned over and said that he had heard labor reporting interested me and asked if I would like to be his leg man, as it was then called, on two big issues he was covering. The growing confrontation on the waterfront, involving a possible lockout of the warehousemen's union, and a threatened retail store clerk's strike against the city's department stores. I responded with a vigorous and enthusiastic assent, and thus began a long story that absorbed me for many weeks in the San Francisco waterfront and with many of the major figures involved in it. At the time I began working on the lockout, the longshoremen and warehousemen, those who loaded and unloaded the ships, and those who stored the goods from the port in the warehouses and removed them later, were organized into one big union, the International Longshoremen and Warehousemen's Union, ILWU. The distributors from all the industries, tired of being knocked over one by one and whipsawed against each other by this increasingly powerful union, got together and decided to exert their united front by locking out the ILWU so they could negotiate a master contract for the whole waterfront. When a strike occurred at the Woolworth warehouse, the Distributors Association brought in a boxcar loaded by non-union people and ordered it unloaded. A hot car, as it came to be dubbed, meaning a railroad freight car loaded by strikebreakers, was sent up and down the waterfront, stopping at each warehouse, where the employees were asked to unload it. When the union members refused, they would either go out on strike or be locked out of work as a result. One of my jobs as a reporter on this story was to follow the hot car on its journey along the waterfront, observe each warehouse on which it called and the ensuing work stoppage, and report back to Elliot. So my beat became the waterfront, and my ports of call were the ILWU, the Distributors Association, and the Pacific Coast Labor Bureau, another strong force in the picture. The Bureau was a group of radical economists and professional negotiators for the unions, headed by Henry Melnikoff. One of its ablest and toughest but most charming members was Sam Cagle, a highly successful negotiator for the ILWU, who had no love for newspaper people. Luckily for me, however, of all the papers covering the waterfront, he disliked the News least,